I think we have, we're going to discuss some pretty interesting things. And why don't you start off, Eck?
Yeah, what we're going to do, one of the things we're going to be talking about.
Hang on. That was awesome.
What was that?
There's like a 9-hour delay.
You had the happiest seizure I've ever seen, dude.
I was trying to find the fucking tab.
Well, you could just cut out the delay, can't you?
And
but which was my point, which is why I was terribly quiet while I was doing it.
All right,
so
we'll start off with that.
Nick, do his fucking
cut this crap out right here.
All right, you know what's great about that? We have our intro.
Hello and welcome to episode 16 of Good Listening, Bad Voltage, which I would like to point out in Axe honor is brought to you by the letter J.
Yay!
I think we have a pretty interesting show lined up for you, and what are we going to talk about this week, guys?
Well, in a world in which an awful lot of software development communities have abandoned the GNU public license, we're going to ask, is the GPL still relevant?
I'm also going to do an interview of a tool that's actually been around for a while called Balsamiq that's used to create mock-ups and user interfaces. But I think it's worth talking about, so I'm going to get into that and whether it's useful for modern open source projects.
And after Jono interviews that piece of software, we are going to talk about how some terrible, terrible people on the internet want the right to be forgotten.
And we'll also be interviewing Ilana Rabinovich, who is the president of the Linux Fund, the organizer of the Texas Linux Fest, and the co-founder of Scale, which you, as Jono would put it, eagle-eared listeners will notice that we've talked about a few times in the past.
Now, Jeremy, what's next? What do we do now?
It's a good question. And now, Bad Voltage.
Now, I think all of the humble correspondents present on the show today, we've all been using Linux for quite some time. And I think it's fair to say that one of the things that got us all into this is the GNU public license, the GPL, the idea that, you know, you can create software and anybody can share it, but they have to contribute their contributions under the same license. It's fantastic. It's genius, right? And it's been around. It's like a staple of how we do things in the open source world, the free software world. But the question is it still relevant, right? Because when the GPL came out, it was quite a different landscape in terms of software than we have today. Now we've got things like the cloud, and we've got, you know, different services that are on different devices. We've got the Internet of Things that's happening, all of this stuff, right? And I remember one time I went to an event which was primarily kind of attracting like a business crowd. And they, one of the case studies that we were doing, they had to choose a license, and the Apache license was by far preferable to the GPL. The GPL was actively recommended, like discouraged within these business settings. So what do you guys think? Is the GPL still relevant today? Is it still serving the needs of open source and free software?
I think the GPL is definitely relevant for those who really believe in its goals, you know, the importance of software freedom for both the programmer and the end user. So I think the more important question is it going to be more generally relevant moving forward? And I don't know what you guys think about that aspect of it.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Jeremy. I mean, it's relevant because people want it and use it. I mean, the Linux kernel is using it. You know, Linus Torvalds adopted it and uses it. And there's no sign that he's going to stop using it. So it's relevant. Yeah. But that said, I mean, all the BSD projects don't use it. I mean, you know, NetBSD, PCBSD, FreeBSD, they don't need the GPL license. The GPL license doesn't really work for non-software related items. So it's not really relevant to anything that's not software. I mean, it just, it works a bunch of crap if you want to write a book or a movie or something like that. It doesn't work for online stuff. So it's not terribly relevant for web-related stuff. I mean, some people do use it for a lot of web libraries, but really, it's not, like you were saying, most people would prefer something like Apache or something along those lines, or the MIT or BSD for web stuff. So it's not really relevant for that, but for the projects that want it, it's still relevant, and I think that's fine.
And I think E3 specifically, Google, Apple, a lot of those larger companies explicitly don't allow it, where they will allow GPL2.
Right.
But I think part of the problem, it became kind of clear, at least to me, in 2007 or thereabouts when they were doing the GPL stuff, GPL3 stuff, that it's really become more of a political platform for the Free Software Foundation than just a software license. And I think that got them into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I mean, something
totally
Brian said,
right?
Something Brian said, I think I disagree with, amazingly enough.
Weird.
Spending a bunch of time doing web stuff, which I do, there's massive discouragement of using the GPL and copyleft licensing there. It's all open source. Almost everything you're using to build modern web applications, both client-side and server-side, it's all open. But none of it is copylefted. And I think a large portion of that is that people can't be arsed dealing with the whole copyleft thing. If everything's BSD, Apache, whatever, you just go, fine, I'm just going to include this in my project. Not a problem, whatever. Then I can do what I want with it. If I end up running a company, I don't have to release a source if I don't want to. I can just include whichever projects I like, no problem. The instant you drop one single GPL thing into there, it then virally infects everything else. And yes, Jono was talking about the open source community, but what he's really talking about is the Linux community. The Linux community has a long history of having a bunch of GPL software. At that point, if almost everything you're using is GPL, then you just go find everything we're going to do is GPL, and you have the same, I don't really have to worry about licensing sort of problem. But the web world set up a new world in which most stuff wasn't GPL, and therefore introducing a bit of GPL stuff is toxic. Because then you go, well, I don't want that. I don't want to have to track my licenses and everything. I don't want to be sure that I'm releasing code and I'm prepared to send you a CD with the code on it, right? The hell with that. We're just not going to use GPL stuff.
Well, I was going to say, I think one of the things about the thing I have always loved about the GPL is that if you want to make a software project and you always want it to be free and you always want it to be fundamentally driven by a community of contributors, the GPL is perfect, right? Because you don't have to care about licensing. You just say it's licensed under the GPL. The expectations are set very clearly. People understand how the license works, the kind of people who are going to contribute to your project. But I think increasingly that scenario is increasingly limited, right? Because these days, most open source projects, or most big open source projects, they have people from different companies with different IP and, you know, licensing requirements. And they have, you know, all these internal requirements around how they contribute to software. I think back when the GPL was created, it was primarily just volunteers, and it served that very well. Like, every project I've ever worked on has always been licensed under the GPL, but I've only ever intended it to be a volunteer project. So,
and importantly, all the projects you've worked on, the sorts of projects you're talking about, are very self-contained. You build a project, you work on that project, and that's it. The idea behind this is why something like GTK or Qt are not GPL, because it would mean that every application you wrote with them had to be GPL. They're libraries, so they're under the library GPL, which the FSF have tried to rebrand as lesser GPL to convince you not to use it. But whereas certainly the web world, projects aren't self-contained. You're building frameworks, libraries, things to drop into and combine into a larger project.
Now,
which is why there's this anti-copyleft sort of vibe in there, because most of what most people are writing are libraries. You know, they're writing the equivalent of releasing the equivalent of GTK.
Now, on that note, as I said when we introed this, the GPL has been really a cornerstone for defining the values of free software and open source. If it's becoming less relevant, do you guys think that that's going to make defining those values harder? Because if arguably what you're doing is you're saying, we're going to look to other licenses, and there is more commercial involvement these days, which can complicate things, and the GPL is becoming less relevant, it sounds like the overall kind of protecting that culture is going to be more complicated.
It's not that it's becoming less relevant, but it kind of goes back to what Jeremy was saying earlier, and he really nailed it. With the GPL v3 stuff, they really started moving the license more towards a political platform and political statement and less of a more general license. They wanted to make it very clear that they're making a very direct statement with it. And I got to respect them for doing that. My general thoughts on that are, it doesn't make it any less relevant. It still makes it just as important, but perhaps people will start using different editions of it. Like, a lot of people still use GPL v2 because they're not buying into the whole TiVoization, et cetera, et cetera, stuff in the V3 license. My personal thought is the Free Software Foundation should just say, bag it. We're going to make one license that's just crazy. We're going to make the, I would like them to make GPL extreme. I would like them to make one license that is so extreme and embraces so many of their ideologies that no one who isn't batshit crazy would ever use it. Like I want...
Yeah. Give us some examples of what you'd put into the GPL-X.
in GPL... No way, man. You can go so much further. You take all of Richard Stallman's various thoughts and you combine those bastards together. You take...
Would you have a parrot clause?
No parrot license.
No, that's a separate license.
Clause. There'd be all kinds of weird clauses in there.
There'd be all sorts of weird ones. Clause. But, you know, you do certain things. Like, you take the viral nature of the GPL, which some people like and some people hate, but you take it a step further. You say, if your company adopts a GPLX based piece of code, everything you have within your company that's owned by it is now GPLX, end of story, and you better get that source code out there. Extreme.
That is extreme.
So it's like ultra-violent pathogen kind of approach.
Right. I mean, we're talking 28 days later. People are, those zombies are runners, not lurkers. This is hardcore GPL. I think they should do it because it's a political statement.
Projects. It's viral. It not only virally infects projects it touches, it virally infects people it touches. Like
all organizations. I like this.
And then they pass it on.
Yeah.
I like that. Like, you have to grow a beard if you contribute to the software covered by that license, even if you're a woman.
On your neck.
No. Not if you contribute that software, and not even if you use it. If you walk past someone else using it.
If someone shows you a framed picture of that software, you have to grow a beard and wear slacks.
But see, and no one would use that. But the reality is they need to come out and make a political statement.
Some people would use
it.
That. Some people would use that. There'd be some people out there on Reddit who'd be like, yeah, I'm a GPLX user. And they'd be proud of it.
And you know what? You know, you make Herd use that license just so that it's that much more badass. I think they should go that route.
I will have to say, in doing a little bit of research for this segment, that I don't know if you guys noticed this as well, but the discussion in general, the number of discussions, the depth of the discussions, the amount of people seemingly caring about open source licenses in general really seemed to hit an apex like around that GPL3 time, maybe 2006 to 2009.
Yeah.
People just aren't discussing open source licenses anymore like they used to.
So boring. I think that
it is. And that's one place I think I disagree with one of the things Jono said, that if you choose a GPL, you don't have to care about licensing. I think choosing the GPL means you really do have to care about licensing the most. Some of the other ones are a little bit more permissive, so you kind of don't have to care. Where if you choose the GPS, you have to pay attention.
I think if you're operating in a world where everything else is GPL as well, like the Linux community as a whole, basically everything's GPL, right? So in that kind of world, you don't have to worry about it particularly.
That's what I meant.
That's true.
Because you know that any library you pick up is also going to be GPL. You can combine it without problem. It's when you're trying to mix copyleft and non-copyleft licenses, you suddenly have to care. And as far as I can tell, every community who isn't massively invested in the success of free software, qua free software, right, without a goal in mind other than that free software should succeed, don't see copyleft as a good idea. They see it as a chronic pain in the ass.
Cool. So, pulling this into the finish line, I think it would be good to that licensing is a complicated subject, and I think what's interesting about it is that in many cases, particularly when we talk about free software, it's translating ethics in someone's brain into something that can be used to guide how people collaborate around something. And that's one of the reasons why I think Jeremy's right. Like, there was a pinnacle to those discussions with the GPL V3 stuff, but I think people are just burnt out on some of this. But it's interesting. I think this would be a great thing to reach out to our listeners about. Like, so what do you folks think about the GPL? Is it still relevant? Is it something that people are still using? And also, we'd like to hear your ideas about what should go into the GPLX, because I think we could get some momentum behind this.
Yeah, I honestly think we should write it and just send it over to Richard and say, here you go. This is your next.
Please
one.
Approve this. I would like to add one thing at the end. I know we're running out of time. The Lundu license is most triumphant and I think should be more popular.
What is... Like, Lunduk, you mentioned this in the show notes. What is this? Like,
the Greater Lunduk license is a license I wrote because the GPL doesn't apply to a lot of the stuff I do, that protects users' rights while still being friendly to producing things like, you know, artwork, movies, music, and books and the like. Basically, it states a number of things like if you make a piece of software that is reliant on a server, you also have to make the server available to people. You know, so if your server goes down, they can keep using it. If you if you buy something, you have to be allowed to resell it to whoever you want. You just can't keep using it. Things like that. So basically, applying things that would make sense in the real physical world to software so that people's rights are respected. And it's all inspired by the works of Bill and Ted and their excellent adventures.
I have to say, I was not expecting that response to the question, what is this Lunduk license? I was expecting something far more inane. So I'm kind of surprised. That seems to make a lot of sense.
It does. It does. It's yeah. So the terms of the GLL, and I'll be very short about this, are three. Very short. One is be excellent to each other. Two is don't be bogus. And three is that we should all party on dudes. And there's more details about that on Lunduk.com.
So on the show now, we've got a friend to many of us. I think the only person he doesn't really know is Brian, who he's met today, but Ilan Rabinovic. Ilan is the co-founder of the Southern California Linux Expo, which previous listeners will know we're huge fans of. He's also the co-founder of Texas Linux Fest, and he's the president of the Linux Fund, which is like a credit card that you can have, and it generates revenue that open source projects can use. So how are you doing, Ilan?
Good. Good to see you guys again.
Yeah, so why don't we start with what you're probably most known for, which is Scale. I mean, we've waxed lyrical about Scale in previous episodes. It's such an awesome event, and it's, you know, Jeremy and I have been going there for, 8 years now. How did that start out? I mean, how did you start something that's become just such a important part of the Linux landscape in the world, not just the US?
Many years ago, before Scale, we used to run an event called the Lugfest out in Los Angeles. It seemed like you couldn't go a block without running into a Linux or open source user group. You know, there's an install fest every 5 minutes back at that point.
Right.
And so LA is sort of a big widespread city where, you know, people don't normally, even if you're in the same city, people weren't always going to all the meetups, and they weren't always running into each other. So we started out as basically a meta user group meeting where we got all the user groups together. We had, you know, every 6 months we'd have a meeting. And at some point the venue that was donated for that was lost. But we didn't want to lose the annual get together. So we thought, well, what if we put together a conference, one that, you know, to show the sessions and the topics that we're actually interested in attending in LA rather than having to travel elsewhere. And so that's sort of where the start of Scale was. And that was, almost 13 years ago now.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it started out in basically a small basement-like room at the University of Southern California here, USC. And, you know, from the first year, we knew we had something exciting that we all enjoyed and that the community wanted us to keep doing.
And, you know, I guess the other main question regarding Scale is how have you dealt with it growing so much? I mean, it's huge now. I mean, maybe just tell us how big generally it is, just so people get an idea of the size. And then how have you dealt with that scale as it's become like a key part of the conference circuit nowadays?
Yeah. So when Scale started, we were, you know, we were at a couple hundred folks at USC. This past year, we were just over 2,800 attendees.
Wow. Nice.
And so I'd guess it's going to be even larger next year. So it's definitely a lot more work than it was 13 years ago. But you know, we've grown the core organizing team each year. We seem to be able to draft more folks every year from attendees. Usually somebody who says they would like to see something different about Scale. We say, great, come on board, make it happen. that's one way we've dealt with the scale. Sorry for the pun there. The other is we've brought in other groups to run their own events at scale for when sort of to help grow the content that's available as well as the number of days without necessarily having all the work fall on the core organizers. So for example, from the Ubuntu community, we have folks running UbuCon. You know, the local DevOps meetups in LA, they run their own DevOps track the day before scale. So it's grown from just being a open source specific event run by us to being a from being an open source general event run by us to being a community event where we're bringing in organizers from their own communities to run their own events at scale. It's sort of become a hub to for other open source projects. And so this year we're looking to add even more events like that. In 2015, we're actually going to likely add a whole another day for more community organizers that want to run, conferences for their open source projects, basically.
I think the one thing that scale kind of represents to me is the shift from kind of the large national or global Linux events like Linux World to the kind of more regional events such as, you know, Scale itself and Linux Fest Northwest, which I know Brian's a fan of, and the Texas Linux Fest, which you are also an organizer of. Why do you think there was that shift? Because I think it's been a pretty marked shift. The only large, very large conference I can think of anymore is OSCON. You know, the Linux World went out of business, and a couple of the other very large shows just don't happen anymore. So why do you think it is that people are gravitated more towards the regional Linux Fest?
So I think there was it's the sense of community, and we're coming here from the open source and Linux communities where we're interested in seeing each other and seeing the project that we're working on, not necessarily having it be a 100% sort of or even 80% commercial pitch, right? And if you look at sort of the content as well as the exhibitors that you see at a scale or a Texas Linux Fest or SELF or any of these other ones that you mentioned, it's more of a 50-50 split between the community aspect and the commercial aspect, which gives it a different energy. People want to be there rather than people being sent there from their employers to get a sales pitch or to get to get specific training.
A question there. I mean, Jeremy referred to Scale as a regional thing, and obviously, you are the Southern California Linux Expo. But is it really regional? Are you getting 2,800 people just from Southern California? Or is it now essentially a national or global conference, which just happens to have a regional name?
I would say it's the latter. We get folks coming in from all over the world these days. Mostly the US, but it has turned into a global attendee base.
Nice. So you guys have basically become like the San Diego Comic-Con of the Linux world.
That's a nice comparison, actually.
I like that.
With fewer outfits, with less anime, I guess.
I will say I like my scale experience enough that even if I were to not be in the Linux or open source community anymore. And that's not an indication that I'm going to do that. I would fly from New York every year to California to attend.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yeah. I agree. It's that sense of... To me, it's like a reunion every time you go there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you see a lot of the same people. And they're not there because, like, they're bored. They're there because they want to be there. And it's such a good time. And you learn something and you hang out with people. Like, you guys have got the balance just so perfect that it's really rewarding going there every year.
Right. Change of subject.
That's the feedback we get from a lot of our attendees. It's not, it's not just the organizers or specific groups. So that's the feedback we get from a lot of our attendees. That's what they appreciate about scale, and so that's what we strive to keep.
Excellent. I want to change the subject because I knew a bit about scale. I think a lot of people will do, but there's something about a credit card which benefits open source people. I don't know anything about this. What's that?
Sure. So Linux Fund is a Linux Fund and our sister card BSD Fund are a credit is a credit card where for every dollar you spend on the card, we get a percentage of that from the credit card company. It's a US based program. We work with US Bank and we take those funds that we've collected from the credit card transactions, and we put them towards supporting open source projects, open source events, and the like. That doesn't necessarily have to be open source software. We've sponsored open hardware in the past as well.
Just on that note, by the way, I'd just like to give one example of where this money is used. For the last, I think, 3 years now, Linux Fund has sponsored the Community Leadership Summit every year. So, like, they cut us a check, and that helps to go towards coffee and stuff like that. It's, like, it's awesome, you know? You know, but the point is that it's helping communities get together and do stuff, you know?
Sure. So, I mean, to give you examples of projects we've supported, there was an OpenBSD developer, this about a year back, who really wanted to improve HP multifunction printer support in OpenBSD. He reached out to us, I believe, or we reached out to him, and we arranged for a printer of the type he's looking to, add drivers for, to show up at his house in France. And he got the printer. He worked on the drivers. Commits showed up, I believe, a month or two later. So it's, it's not just events that we're looking to support, but rather we want to enable software development on open source software and hardware development at all levels. Mm-hmm. Especially for things that are smaller, especially on smaller projects, if we can. We like to find things where a smaller donation will help unblock a project. Like, if you need a build server, great. If you need if you need a piece of hardware for a debugging project or for adding drivers or anything like that, that's fantastic too. It's hard for us to make a big difference in an organization that's receiving maybe millions of dollars in funding from commercial backers, but if we can help, open source, smaller open source projects or individual developers get to somewhere that they need to be, and unblock development, we're very happy to do that.
Cool. I appreciate you probably can't tell us like all of the details, but can you give us an idea of how popular the card is? I mean, how many people are using it, or how much money you can give out to projects? Can you give us a ballpark kind of figure of how utilized this is? Because it's neat.
It's not new. It's been around since back. So I it's not an organization I started, actually. I found out, I personally learned about it at Linux World Expo back in the early, probably 2000, probably 2002, 2003 days, maybe around that time. We've given out close to, we're getting close to about, I think we're getting close to $1 million here in donations that we've made over the last decade plus.
That's incredible.
So we were founded in 1999, and we've gone through a few incarnations, but we've supported a number of projects over the years. So if you're interested in applying the best or learning more about what we do, the best place to go is linuxfund.org. We list a number of projects there. We've supported development on the GNASH project. A few years back, somebody was working on an open source graphics card based on open hardware. We had worked with them to put together the orders for that, as well as the funding and development for that.
Would you mind, just on a very quick note, like, we're talking about the development of the GPL Extreme license, which is going to be the no holds barred approach to comedy licensing. So can we ask for maybe, $200,000-$300,000 for that? Would that help?
I think we can do it for 150.
150?
Yeah.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah.
Also, I need to go to paint my bathroom. If you've got any spare money. Slightly more serious note.
On a serious note, if you are interested in funding for an open source project that you're working on, if there's something that we can help provide to unblock you on some effort you have and you're working on, just drop us a note, funding@linuxfund.org, and we'll get in touch with you quickly and help you work through the proposal process.
I'm thinking less here about the people getting funding from you and more about the people giving funding to you. Is there, if you're a supporter of free software, open source, and you have a credit card and you're in the US, is there any reason why you shouldn't have a Linux Fund credit card? Shouldn't everyone just get one?
We would love that. It would definitely help us with our work supporting open source software. I don't see any reason why not. We've got a number of programs available. If you're a fan of your frequent flyer miles or the points that you might get from your credit card, there's a number of different programs that we offer that let you keep some percentage of that. So
Right.
Awesome.
And
nice.
Is there like a, I mean, how transparent do you run this as well? Because I imagine that a lot of people who are part of this program will think, I want to see where this money is going, as opposed to,
so,
you know.
So we're a 501c3 nonprofit. We do report on our finances to the, you know, to the IRS, and that to some, you know, to, that that is public to some extent. We publish a report fairly regularly on who we've donated to.
Right.
And I will happy to send a link along for the show notes.
Awesome. Well, Elan, you know, thank you so much for coming on the show. I know this is not the first time, you know, we've said this to you, but like, thank you for everything you do. Like, you've contributed so much to helping get people together to talk about free software and open source and further it through your many different things, even if that includes getting drunk in a bar one night with us, which is also a contribution. So yeah.
So one last plug here, as I'm as it sounds like you're playing me off with some music there. So Texas Linux Fest is on June 13th and 14th in Austin, Texas. It's a sister event to Scale, run by the same nonprofit. So if you're able to make it out, if you're there in Texas, or if you can fly into town, love to have you out there. It's TexasLinuxFest.org. That's again June 13th and 14th. And
perfect.
And I should point out, at least one presenter from Bad Voltage will be there.
Ah. Okay, then. It's not me. So
it's not me either.
And do you have dates for Scale next year yet?
We do. It will be, I should know this. One moment. it will be the 19th through the 22nd of February, 2015.
Nice.
So mark
get
your
that
calendars.
On your calendar. And nice. I know Jeremy and I will definitely be there, but we're going to see if we can get Ack and Brian out. Maybe we can do a show there. That'd be awesome.
That'd be tight.
So
we'd love to have you guys out.
And maybe we can get Linux Fund to pay for our airfares. Just saying.
I thought Bad Voltage wasn't an open source specific show.
It is.
That's a really good point, Jono.
It is very fundamentally non-profit, though, Bad Voltage, but not because we're opposed to the idea of profit. We're just not going to make any.
Yeah, it was just, it's never going to be profit, right? So, brilliant. Well, thanks, Elan, and all the best for the future.
See you soon.
All right.
Bye. See you.
There's recently been a remarkable ruling by the European Court of Justice. There's a chap called Costeja Gonzalez, who's Spanish.
What was that?
Yeah, say that again.
I'm not at all sure I've got that right, and I'm not saying it.
You only really get one go at that, by the way, but because we're arseholes, you get to say it again.
No,
what was that?
No, sir, right? That chap, Spanish guy, a few years ago, he had his house, I think, repossessed, and it was auctioned off to cover debts related to a business. He then turned around and sued both the website which published, the governmental public website which publishes details of when these things have happened, and Google for indexing that page to say, I would like those pages to be removed, please. Now, importantly, people are calling this the right to be forgotten, and that right already exists in EU law. The idea here is that if people are being unfairly characterised by something which happened 10 years ago, then they have a chance, they should have the opportunity to move beyond that, to have that stuff downplayed to some extent. If you think about the way when someone's being tried, you can't offer evidence of past convictions, even if, you know, this is the 79th time they've been done up for burglary, saying they've already been done up 78 times, while probably relevant information would massively prejudice the jury, so you're not allowed to do it. And the right to be forgotten is similar to that.
That's stupid, by the way.
What's different?
That's like 13 different kinds of dumb.
Right. Yeah. However, nonetheless, anyway, that is the law.
Right. Well, the law's stupid.
Europeans are stupid.
What's interesting about this is that what the European Court of Justice said was that the actual...
I'm going to get emails.
the actual newspaper page, which declared that the thing had happened, didn't have to be removed. The guy couldn't demand that the newspaper remove the article about him from their website because that's public interest. But Google did have to remove links to it basically because it was giving it undue prominence. They're like, this stuff, you know, you can't completely eradicate it from existence, but you're allowed to make it harder to find. What do you guys think?
History is history. You don't get to rewrite it, is my view.
He's not talking about rewriting it.
Agreed.
The court has explicitly said you are not allowed to completely eradicate this from history. You can't drop things down the memory hole. But we are now in a position where a reasonable argument for the way someone is perceived is the top page of results in Google when you type their name in.
Right, but that is formulated from so many different mechanics, right? I mean, that's popularity of those pages. It's whether, you know, there's all kinds of different ways in which Google rank that. And I don't know how Google will do that. I don't think anyone other than a small number of people at Google.
I'm not even sure Google knows anymore.
Yeah, Google doesn't know.
Yeah, I think it's
a giant, really retarded Perl script that figures it out.
But the way I understood the ruling, right, Google does not have to remove the article from their data set. They only can't return it for his exact name. So if you searched for 123 foreclosed upon Ave, that article would show up. But if you searched for his name, it would not.
What the guy
that's rewriting history. The point of that.
But that basically turns the Google search results for your name into a curated list of, it's like an about me page at that point.
Right, exactly.
Yes,
right.
I think that's ludicrous. I mean, I sympathize with people who are gaming Google to character assassinate somebody. So the classic example of this is Rick Santorum, right? Some of you may not be familiar with this, but there's a guy, Dan Savage, I think his name is, who really opposed this guy, Rick Santorum, who is a very, very conservative American politician. And he basically... I think the lols were strong in this one, to be honest with you, but he basically orchestrated a campaign to define Santorum as something like, it's the frothy mix of lube and fecal matter or something like that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. He made it a disgusting sex act. Yeah.
And he, you know, because this guy would be deeply offended by that. So while the lols were strong in that one, it was actually a massive dick move to do that towards Santorum. And I think that that's wrong. You shouldn't be able to do that, but for Google to just do its regular thing and those results appear near the top because that's of general public interest, I don't see Google being in the wrong about that.
That's the point. The exact point, it's not of general public interest. It's a thing which happened 15 years ago. You shouldn't
black... Doesn't stop it being of public interest.
Lenin was shot forever. There is a statute of limitations on stuff for a reason. You shouldn't be penalised for your whole entire life for things you did early on.
Okay, so Hitler, we should forget about that then?
Really? That's your argument.
Snap.
Well done. There it is. Wow, John. I'm convinced.
Right. I thought you'd like that. But seriously,
Hitler,
big things happen in people's lives that don't go forgotten about, right? I mean, you know...
Right to have them forgotten about.
Right, and that legal right is bullshit.
However, it is the legal right.
It totally is.
Yeah, but that doesn't make it okay just because it's the legal right.
You're really trying to balance privacy and freedom, and those are two really fundamental rights.
No, I think that's a law is different to a right.
Right.
Sorry, Jeremy, go ahead.
If your argument is the law is wrong, fine, oppose the law. But you're not opposing the law. You're saying this guy shouldn't be able to do this, even though he's legally permitted to do so, because John O'Bacon, the guy who makes arguments involving Hitler, don't like it.
Wait a second. It kind of sounds like John O is exactly opposing the law. He actually called the law... What word did you use?
Bullshit.
He called it bullshit. That sounds to me amazingly like he's opposing the law.
So which other legal rights do you think people should be prevented from doing because you don't like them?
Well, there's... I mean, it doesn't...
Brendan Eich is absolutely allowed to donate stuff to whoever, donate money to whoever wants.
So you're telling me that you believe that every law is perfectly sound?
No, I'm telling you, if you have a problem with the law, contest the law. Don't contest that's, people doing
that's
things
what
the
I'm
law
doing.
Permits.
I'm but saying I think the law thing here is bullshit.
The right for freedom, right? It doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? It coexists with a bunch of other laws and a bunch of other rights, and you've got to weigh how important each of them is in relation to each other. And that's really, really difficult because society has a right to know a lot of certain things. And I think the law of unintended consequences is going to come in huge here. You already have pedophiles trying to get their names removed from sex offender lists and a whole bunch of things that and the public should know about those things. So, I mean, you already have laws. If something's libelous, it should be taken down and the original source should be taken down because it's libelous. But the but right to be forgotten is a very weird line to me. And it depends on how much in the public you are as a person, how important the data is, what the data is.
Yes.
So I can't find a way that Google could automate this in any sane fashion, and by not being able to automate it, it will be so cost prohibitive that they'll probably just honor every request, and that's a terrible precedent.
Right.
Terrible. The thing is, that's a fine
argument against, right? Don't get me wrong. But I think on balance, I don't like this idea either because of the potential for abuse. That for every one guy who's like, man, seriously, I made one mistake when I was 18, I have to pay for it for 50 years, there'll be 1,000 politicians who want to get a wrong thing they did expunged from the public eye when they shouldn't be able to. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a bad idea because of the precedent it sets. I don't think the thing itself is inherently bad like you three seem to.
I think it's horrible. I think it's one of the worst things ever. I mean,
I think the thing is,
go ahead, John.
I was going to say, the way I look at it is, the Hitler example was obviously pithy, but there's a point to it, is that people do things in their past that should still be considered, and they should be still considered in the scheme of things. Now, I agree with you, Ak, that some people make a mistake, early on in their lives and whatever, and they shouldn't be tortured by that forever, right? But I think Google isn't set up to do that. I think what happens is bad things that happened to certain people previously in their careers or in their lives will eventually get forgotten, and they'll be buried by the good stuff that they're doing today. Google optimizes content on the internet around active stuff, right?
Right.
If you're doing lots of active stuff today, anything past page 2 on Google, no one gives a crap about. It's really the first couple of pages, right? And
you shouldn't have to do a bunch of good stuff in order to push it down the results.
My point is that the system is set up where things from the past can be forgotten, right?
Yes.
But the system should not be set up where people can say, I want to hide this.
That's the point. The system is not set up to do that. Because if you don't do anything Google noticeable and you type that name into Google, they're going to come up with the thing from 30 years ago because it's all they know about. That is in itself not enough of a reason. Saying, well, yeah, this is a problem, but we can't work out a way to do it with a Perl script, so we're just not going to do it, is bloody unlucky.
But in any case, to Jeremy's point, it doesn't matter, right? Technology is, this is not a solvable problem, right? Because you can get Google to change their search results. What about the other 100 search engines?
Right. That's just people Facebook? Just use DuckDuckGo or something.
This is not a solvable problem. Like, this is the issue with privacy, right? Is that, I can take a picture of a friend of mine in a crowded market and that, 100 other people will be in that picture. Right, I can tag that person, but I don't get their permission if I take that picture.
You're missing the point.
I think it's sometimes difficult to force technology to comply to our arbitrary social norms, and I think that's what's happening here.
I mean, this is the point. Right. The court very explicitly said, you cannot have this completely removed from the internet. The original newspaper article, you cannot compel them to take it down. It's public interest. What they're worried about is the fact that because everyone uses Google and Google are the arbiter of everything, right, that it's giving it undue prominence. One of Google's arguments was, we're in the US. We don't have to listen to EU data protection laws.
It's not up to Mr.
flagrant bullshit.
Costeja Gonzalez what other people and other companies give prominence. He has no right to tell Google, to tell me, to tell Jono that we can or can't write an article about him, that we can't show something about him in search results. He just simply doesn't have that right. And nor should he.
He does have that right. That's exactly the right he has.
See, now here's the thing. In my mind, he just simply doesn't. The mistakes that we make in our past are good things. They are part of the tapestry, the beautiful tapestry that makes up the ridiculousness that is our lives. If you do a Google search for my name, you find good stuff and a whole lot of stuff people could object to. And people do right. on a fairly regular basis. And I would hate right. it if that stuff disappeared. Now, if I have a website and I don't want stuff on there anymore, I take it off my website. But if someone else yeah. wants to write an article, take a screenshot, take a picture of it, great. More power to them. That's part of history. That's part of what makes us who we are, both as individuals yeah. and as a people.
It's accountability.
And we cannot yeah. remove that. That if I'm doing something awesome now, it is because in my past, I did some pretty stupid crap. And I guarantee you all four of us are the same way. And taking away yeah. that stupid crap makes the cool stuff we do now less interesting and less cool. The same goes for this Mr. Costeja Gonzalez. If he had a problem 7 years ago, 10 years ago, and doesn't anymore, that is a victory. That is a triumph. He should celebrate that rather than try and erase his past and eradicate the things he did in the past. I think he's going about it the wrong way.
And the thing is, as well, is Ak, I think what you're talking about in some ways, which is an interesting, maybe a side discussion that we can have in another show, is Google has become so ubiquitous that it's become a social function, right? Yeah. It's become part of what makes us people. Like, Google is as part of what makes us human beings as being able to access clean drinking water.
Or bowel movements.
But it's controlled but it's controlled by a private company. And we essentially have to trust that that private company is going to operate in the best interests of its, you know, of billions of people who use it.
Which is kind of the point. The government.
We totally don't have to assume that. I mean, it doesn't matter if they do or not.
Government operates on that kind of scale, but they're required to be accountable. Google don't have to be accountable to anybody. They can do what the hell they like, and no one, because they go, well, no exactly. one forces you to use it. But there comes a point at which you become ubiquitous enough that you have to assume some of that accountability.
Yeah, you can't ignore it, right? I mean, it's like Twitter almost. Anyone, like, if anyone is in the public eye and they don't, they're unwilling to learn what Twitter is and factor that into their lives, then they're making a mistake. And that's just, you have to. That's the world.
They're not making
right?
a mistake. They're making a choice.
Right. Yeah, but in the scheme of things, you have to, like, the world is changing and we have to be adaptable to what's happening in the world. But yeah, so again, I think I can see this blown up on the forums. I can see a lot of people having some cool ideas about this. This is a really interesting discussion. So what do you folks think? Go to community.badvoltage.org and let us know. Do you agree with ACT? Do you believe that there should be some kind of solution to this, or do you believe with Brian and I that maybe history should stay as is?
And while you're in the forums, be sure to also go over to lugradio.org/gallery, find the most boy band looking photos of Jono and Stuart you can, and repost those in the forum, because those exist forever and can never be taken down.
They were the best photos ever.
Hang on a second. Let's wrap this up. Let's wrap this up in an interesting way. I want each of us to tell our listeners, what's the most embarrassing thing that you think's on the internet? I know it's going to take you a while, Brian, to think of something.
Yeah,
right?
I was going to say, man, I don't know.
So we'll go to you last. Let's start with Jeremy. I mean, Jeremy's pretty squeaky clean.
I really can't think of anything, if you search my name, that I would want in any way, shape, or form removed.
See, I would want removed. See, I've made mistakes, but I don't want anything removed.
About what you want removed. I know most of us would leave it as it is. But what would you say is your weakest moment?
There are
that's
an awful
online?
Lot of terrible, terrible photos of me from early Lug Radio things and stuff like that. And
so go get those Lug Radio pictures while you can, because Ek will clearly submit a removal request from Google.
I think it'll be interesting. I mean, I agree. Yes, people go and find pictures of Jono and I from Lug Radio's past and post them embarrassingly. Bear in mind, we're not the only people to have done a podcast and had a bunch of embarrassing pictures taken of us, Brian Lundig.
So, it's so true. Oh man, the pictures people could find
the
of
Lug
me.
Radio pictures, all of which are fantastic and make us look like rock stars, with a bunch of pictures of Brian, which really, really, really do not.
Yeah, with Brian's one picture of him sat in front of that green screen that he's been using for the last 15 years.
Dude, yeah, isn't that the truth? There is a series of pictures that people did where they took my face where I was making this crazy, I call it my happy rape face, because it's me going like this. And it's me with the most ridiculous smile, my eyes really wide and looking creepy. They took that and they posted it just like all over the place. They put it on all sorts of like random, like other women in bikinis and things like that. And that's everywhere. and I wouldn't have it any other way.
I would just like to point out to the listener that the face Brian just made on the Hangout is why this is an audio-only show and will always be an audio-only show.
Yeah, I'd also like it noted for the record that before somebody contacts Google to have this episode removed from their search results, the term happy rape face is copyright Brian London, not Bad Voltage. I just want to make that very clear. For quite some time now, our humble correspondent, Mr. Stuart Denise Langridge, and I have shared an interest in user interface design. Many an hour has been merrily toiled throwing away preconceived notions of how user interfaces work and trying to connect fresh interfaces with what feels natural to us as people. In all of these cases, our exploration has been fun and entertaining, but one aspect has always bitten us on the collective bottom. We both have about as much artistic talent as wife beater wearing rabid pig dogs with an addiction to meth and chewing tobacco. In a nutshell, no artistic talent. Consequently, the tools of our trade became hand gestures and pens and paper. Not sufficient, I'm sure you'll agree. In recent years, balsamic has changed all of that. Although not particularly tasty sprayed all over your fish and chips, this kind of balsamic provides a simple tool for creating user interfaces. It basically provides a collection of pre-drawn user interface components, such as labels, combo boxes, search boxes, etc., as well as more primitive shapes, such as lines, rectangles, and other bits and bobs. This collection of mock widgets then becomes the crayons that you use to create your interfaces. You simply drag and drop them, resize and configure them to look exactly how you want. The tool is devilishly simple to use, and the range of widgets is wide and expansive. I've used Balsamic over the years for many, many different projects, and I've never found a situation once where an important component or widget was missing. When you've created your designs, there are also labels and highlighters that you can use to annotate your great creation to help those peons understand your wisdom. And finally, you can save the files as normal images so they can be easily shared. Now, Balsamic is available for a download on Linux, Mac, and Windows, as well as available as a browser-based web app. The desktop and web versions basically look and work the same, and are completely free to use apart from a regular nagging message box and the inability to save your designs as images. Now, the nefarious among you can solve that problem by basically screenshotting the window and cropping it, but the honest among you can also register the product for about $79 to escape those limitations. Balsamic doesn't stop there, though. Their My Balsamic collaborative design tool and plugins for Google Docs, Confluence, Jira, and other services all expand the Balsamic universe. Although, to be honest with you, I haven't really used those additions, because I haven't really needed to. My review here is really focused on the core tool, and it's brilliant. If you have an idea for a user interface design in your head, getting it into a mock-up that you can share with other people is dead simple. This is one of those tools that's good enough that it almost makes you want to give them money in the first place. So what is the Bad Voltage verdict? If you want to create mock-ups of user interfaces with the least hassle and fuss as possible, Balsamic is perfect. Simply brilliant.
Let me ask you this question, because, and I just want to say this, Jono, that was the best review of six-year-old software I have ever heard in my life. That was fantastic, by the way. I mean, I'm glad you've been able to use it for several years before writing the review, so you could really get into the meat and potatoes of it. but let me ask you this. Balsamic is, I mean, it's great. It's got a bunch of little doodads, you can bits and bops, as you put it, that you can toss into things, but it's still just a UI designer that's based around the ideas of traditional UI design. So if you're trying to get really wild and crazy and build the next mobile convergence app and everything else, you kind of got to break out of that mold, don't you? Yeah. Or does Balsamic still beneficial?
To a degree. I mean, in their defense, they've added widgets as user interfaces have changed. So for example, I think in some of the early releases, they didn't have things like album spinners, which have become very prominent with the iPhone.
Now, for earlier releases, are you talking releases 3 years ago, like 5 years ago, or 6 years
nine,
ago?
Nine,
10 years ago, okay.
So, you're right, Brian. Like, it basically presumes that you're building user interfaces that will run on WIMP platforms or touch platforms that we have today. If you're wanting to create Minority Report style stuff, then it's not as well served, but you know, that's really pen and paper kind of territory.
And to a large extent, yes, they have done their best to keep up with the standard widgets on a bunch of different platforms. So you get like the Android top bar, which has been added since then, so on and so forth. But yeah, if you're trying to do something radically different to everything else, then the whole idea of using a tool which lets you plug together existing widgets is clearly not going to work. You're creating a genuinely new piece of art. You can't build it up out of bits because that's what being new means.
Yeah.
So the other thing that kind of confuses me, so I actually kind of like Balsamic, but just playing devil's advocate here for a minute. Yeah. All of the great, you know, coding environments out there have really dead, drop dead simple UI designers that require no coding skills. I mean, even for Android, iOS, anything, you just drag some buttons around, plop a toolbar on it, and bam, Bob's your uncle. You've got your whole UI, and now it's a fully functional app that you can actually load up on a device, look at, push some buttons, and it may not do much of anything, but it kind of works. And then you know exactly what it's going to look like instead of, you know, some lines and some pencil.
That's actually
style
where
stuff.
I think like the rough sketch style wireframes are actually better because they help you focus kind of the conversation on the content and the interaction and how the UI will work. When you do that, people tend to focus on the minutiae and the details and not liking the color of a button, which in the end is not really the important part of UI.
And more importantly, if I agree with you, Brian, if you're using any kind of decent, capable full stack IDE, then yes, it will give you the ability to essentially sketch an app out of real widgets, and then it's a real app. But then you say, okay, guy building the Mac version, here's my Visual Studio file, and he goes, well, I can't open it. Right? I mean, a diagram is inherently cross-platform.
There is a good point for that, yeah.
The thing is, as well as, and one thing I forgot to mention in the review monologue is, yes, Balsamic is very much focused on interface design. It's not designed for
visual design tool. No.
I mean, really, frankly, you need to use something like the GIMP or Photoshop or whatever to focus on visual design. But to Jeremy's point, I think it's good that it focuses on just the nuts and bolts of how you want your UI to work. But the other thing as well is
it's a tool for building wireframes.
Yeah, based upon my experience of using those kind of rapid IDE development things, they're not as flexible as you'd imagine. Like I've tried using things like with Qt and Android and various other bits and pieces, and there's a lot of limitations because generally those UI builders are limited in the way that you can use in the hierarchy of how those widgets can be used. So if you want to do something genuinely crazy and it isn't practically deliverable in code, then you can't represent that. And also they're often very complicated in terms of things like spacing, because typically it's all relative spacing, but with Balsamic you can use the anchors to line everything up, or you can do whatever you want.
An actual IDE tool is essentially, yes, the benefit is that once you finish drawing your essentially wireframe, you're 3/4 of the way to making an app. But the disadvantage of that is that you have to be 3/4 of the way to making an app.
Yeah.
If it would require more work than that to make the app, then it just won't let you do it. Question. Balsamic, if I remember rightly, they had a thing in the past where if you were using it for an open source project, it was free.
Yeah.
Is that still the case?
I believe so. We did this with Ubuntu when we announced the phone. One of the things we wanted to do was to, you know, start building a community of designers around Ubuntu. And we reached out, we wanted to build these core apps, and we originally said, like, people create their designs in Balsamic, they can go and use the web version, and then they can attach them to wiki pages, basically. And then Balsamic got in touch with us and said, look, we provide my Balsamic for free for open source projects, and you can use it to collaborate around designs and things like that. So people started using it, and it was huge. I mean, there was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of designs put in there. It really kind of unlocked, I think, a lot of our design community, because I feel bad for open source designers, because I think they have very limited tools, particularly around collaborating with each other. Like, Inkscape is awesome for creating visual designs. GIMP is awesome for that kind of stuff. But for working together on something, it's more complicated. And Balsamiq really just unlocked a lot of that, I think, design thinking a lot of people.
I just checked really quick. They do offer it for free if you are, as they put it, a do-gooder. But you have to email them with a short blurb of how you do the good, whether you're a nonprofit charity or open source committer, and they will send you, they say, a free license of it. I think that's actually really wicked cool. That's the other thing I didn't know they did, they have a plugin for Google Drive.
Yeah. You didn't listen to my review?
I didn't even know that.
You didn't listen to my review, Lundy?
I don't listen to half of what you say, dude.
Plugin for Google Docs, plugin for Conference, plugin for Jira.
Yeah. I've never
All I could figure out from your review is that apparently it doesn't taste good on fish and chips. The rest of the words made absolutely no sense to me.
I was going to say, the only thing I got out of it is that their logo should be a wife-beating rabid pig dog with an addiction to meth and chewing tobacco.
Yeah, that's I did hear that too, that was good.
Which I think says more about you guys than the review.
I think probably.
So yeah, I'd say just overall.
Oh, Americans.
I'd say overall, you know, if people want something, a good tool. And, you know, props to the Balsamiq people. They seem like a pretty solid group, you know.
Yeah, they really
like what they'd be doing. And,
that seems really cool, actually, yeah. This is the end of what we call Bad Voltage. I want to thank everyone. Yeah. Everyone, every single person, even the people that didn't enjoy listening, for listening to this show, because it was awesome that they did it. It was awesome, and it made me happy, and it made me get all goosebumpy, and I liked it, and I think they should do it again. Now, guys, we have one very important thing we have to figure out before we close out this most bodacious of all episodes.
What's that? What's that?
Jono, once again, you have forced us to reschedule this program. You have forced us to rechange our whole lives to accommodate the Jono schedule. So,
what are you talking about? I got stuff going on right now.
So,
there's more to my life than you guys.
I don't want to hear anything from Jono right now. I want to hear from Stuart and Jeremy. We get the opportunity to change Jono's avatar in the forum again. Again.
We're going to reach a point where his avatar has been something we've chosen more than it's been his actual avatar.
People aren't going to know what he actually looks like anymore.
Right, but here's the thing, right? You know what, Jeremy? You have the right to mock me on this topic. Ak, you have the right to mock me on this topic. Lunduk, right? You've only showed up for like, you know, 60% of the shows, right?
Although lucky for him, we instituted this rule after he missed most of them.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Since we instituted it, you notice I've been on my game.
By the way, speaking of which, I just thought of something. Given the fact that we generally believe, and I believe Ak will share this view, that you shouldn't erase history, and you believe this, Lunduk, maybe we should change your avatar for the next couple of months.
No. Can't make any retroactive laws.
Yeah, we can't do retroactives, but when it comes time, and I'm sure it will, that I do something that's changeable, you guys can go crazy with it.
Yep,
and you know what? I'm going to pony up. I'm going to man up, because I'm not just going to change my avatar in the forum. I'll change my Twitter handle avatar too.
Really?
Because I'm a man with cojones the size of friggin' watermelons, and I can handle that.
And that's exactly what the picture is going to be of.
You're also a man that no one follows on Twitter, evidently.
Evidently. Okay, so what could we have for Jono's avatar? I reckon what we should have is like some cartoon talking kale. Right?
That's not bad.
I think that's a fantastic idea. Do you have any other thoughts, Brian?
It's not bad. Well, this morning I was eating this big sausage, and you guys were mocking me a little bit, and Jono was nice enough to take a screenshot of me eating a sausage during the recording.
I
think it should be
avatar.
Me eating a sausage. Yeah, we could make it Jono's avatar.
Oh, right. I think we should have a vote. Right.
I'm not sure if, by the way, this is a bad reflection on me or you. That is not a flattering picture of sausage consumption.
I beg to disagree. Any picture of sausage consumption is flattering.
Right. Okay, let's have a vote. We have the three of us, right? So, Brian, what's your vote for?
I say it's sausage picture.
Jezza?
It's difficult to vote against sausage picture.
Oh, man, it's got to be. It has to be the sausage picture. Okay, so, Jono Bacon, your penalty for rescheduling the show again for the second week on the bounce is that for the next 2 weeks, once the show is released, you will look like Brian eating a sausage on community.badvoltage.org.
God damn it. All right.
Yeah. Man, this show is class, you guys. That's what we are. we are pure class.
That's what we do. That's what we do.
Dude, we have as much class as a one-room schoolhouse. There is no class.
And well, I will say, inspired by Jono reviewing a six-year-old or even older piece of software, the next time it's my time to review, I've decided I'm going to do PC DOS or Dr. DOS, which is
Oh, dude, that would
this
be epic,
German
man.
Reviews, Norton Utilities 1.
All right, well, on that note, I guess we should probably wrap it up. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. And thank you again to Ilan Rabinovich. For joining us on the show. And again, thank you to A2 Hosting and to Bytemark for supporting the distribution of these very shows and the discussion. Get involved at community.badvoltage.org. And remember, there's the listening party that happens every day, every time we release the show as well at badvoltage.org/party. Anything else? Are we done?
I think we're done.
Wraps it up.
That's it, man.
All right. Bye, everyone.